Okay. So my name is Brian Holland. I'm one of the pediatric cardiologists here in Louisville, and I've had the honor to serve on the committee as a co-chair to try to put this program together this year. As we were thinking about every year, we recognize a wonderful honorable maestro teacher, and then we have a lecture right afterwards. The decision was to have Dr. Earl Austin, who is a pediatric cardiac surgeon from here in Louisville, who's also been practicing for a long time in the region, talk about an overview of the history of congenital heart surgery here in Kentucky. And so that's going to happen next. And then we're going to have Dr. Subcheck. Walt Subcheck has actually been here almost as long as Dr. Austin has. Dr. Austin started in 1989, and Dr. Subcheck started a year later in 1990. So we're going to have Dr. Subcheck, one of our longtime pediatric cardiologists, introduce Dr. Austin and then give us an overview about congenital heart disease care and surgery in Kentucky.
Thank you, Dr. Holland. So I have the honor to introduce Dr. Earl Austin for your next speaker. Dr. Austin was born in Portsmouth, Virginia, and I'm told he enjoyed the life on the coast and boating in his younger years. He completed his undergraduate education at Dartmouth University, where he found time to play for the football team as a halfback. He finished his medical degree at Harvard. He did 10 years of general cardiac surgery at Duke under Dr. David Sabiston. He did a one-year fellowship at Boston Children's Hospital, completing his training. He spent the first 4 years of his clinical practice at East Carolina University in Greenville, Kentucky. And then we were fortunate enough here in Kentucky to recruit him to come to be the chief of cardiac surgery, pediatric cardiac surgery in 1990. I'm a personal witness to the fact that Earl was for weeks or months on end the only heart surgeon or the only surgeon or the only person taking care of these surgical patients. And he never had more than one associate and or a fellow helping him. However, despite that, he has been incredibly productive in his career. He has over 150 peer-reviewed papers as primary or lead author. He has written over 20 book chapters, and he is a reviewer or on the editorial board of over 10 journals. He's presented lectures nationally and internationally over 40 times. His peers have recognized his excellence, and he is a past president of the Congenital Heart Surgeon Society, and he's on leadership committees for the American Association of Thoracic Surgeons, as well as the Society of Thoracic Surgeons. That's an easy part to explain someone's CV. What I can give personal testimony to is things that don't show up on your CV. And that's the degree of dedication that Dr. Austin has given to this city and this state. He's overseen the growth and development of our program in so many important ways. And he will, and I can testify how hard it can be to grow and develop programs. Where some surgeons with Earl's surgical and educational pedigree not getting something that they're asking for might stomp and scream and threaten to leave. Dr. Austin stomped and screamed and said, I'm not going to leave and I'm going to be a thorn in your side until you get me what I need. And he has done that. Some of the important things that he has accomplished at our center is he moved our cardiac surgical suites and our cath labs from the basement of Norton Hospital to a top floor of the Children's Hospital, something that that our group was told for years couldn't happen. But because of Earl's insistence, it did. He is a driving force in the development of our cardiac ICU with dedicated cardiac intensive care unit doctors. All the while doing all this busy work and with his love of the water and the boating, I know he continued whenever he had a chance to be an avid boater and avid skier. And when he was away, we would hear about his exploits on the double black diamonds in Colorado. Norton has recently acknowledged and shown appreciation for his years of dedication by announcing the development and the funding of an Earl H. Austin endowed chairmanship in pediatric cardiac surgery. And without further ado, I'd like to introduce Dr. Earl Austin.
Thanks, Walt. I mean, I'm sort of choked up after listening to that. Just just so you guys know that this doesn't have a pointer. I got an extra one, so for those of you who need it, who are giving talks, I'll leave it here. And if it's gone, track me down. It's in my pocket. In any event, it's actually a pleasure for me to sort of put together slides to sort of discuss congenital heart surgery in this state. Part of it is I've been here for a pretty good while, but my congratulations to David, who's been here longer. So, and it's certainly well deserved. And I'm trying to retire, so I'm not going to catch up with you. But anyhow, good for you. So, in any event, I recognize. Probably most of you in the audience will probably take care of typically older patients with acquired heart disease, but I did think it was important just to recognize that taking care of patients with birth defects involving their heart is important, and I think you can see that it is the most common birth defect, and it's actually more common than childhood malignancy. It affects a significant number of people in the United States, and it's striking that it has the highest average hospital charges, length of stay, mortality of all birth defects. So it is an important area, and it's something that has been, these patients have been cared for in Kentucky as well as the rest of the country, the rest of the world. And so my job is just to sort of tell you a little bit about what's happened in Kentucky and also to kind of look back on the field of congenital heart surgery over the period of time that I've been involved in it, particularly with most of that time being here in Kentucky. It's important to understand that if you've had heart surgery for a congenital heart defect in Kentucky, it was probably at one of these two places. And obviously, I've been at the one in Louisville, which when I came here was called Cosair Children's Hospital. It's now Norton Hospital, but it's the same building, same people, and everything else, only the name had changed. And importantly, a lot has happened in Lexington at the Kentucky Children's Hospital. And so I'm going to refer a little bit to both. Obviously, most of my knowledge relates to where I've been most of the time, but I'll try to be fair and honest, and if I'm unfair to Lexington, you guys can get to me later. But in any event, it's important to recognize that there are two places where if you had heart surgery for a congenital heart defect, it was one of these two places. The other thing I think it's important to understand is that none of us in the field of congenital heart surgery can go out and do it by themselves. And although I'm focusing primarily on surgery, I want everybody to know that I strongly acknowledge the fact that as a surgeon, I'm just part of a team. And it takes so many other folks to end up with success in the management of these patients, including cardiologists, neonatologists, and you see the entire list, and I don't want to leave out Echotechs and a lot of others who are incredibly important for us. So we couldn't do it, and we couldn't do it well without everybody else. I will say that, obviously, I'm here to talk mostly about surgery, and I do want to kind of go over the surgeons in this state that have been involved with this. As I've sort of separated the two groups, I'll briefly kind of go through these. Obviously, the surgeon who was sort of did most of the congenital heart surgery in Louisville for a long time was Alan Lansing, who actually continued to do it even after Dr. Mavrudis arrived and even while I was here. Dr. Mavrudis was hired by the university back in the early 1980s, and you'll hear more about Dr. Mavrudis, who goes by Gus. And when I came in 1989, As Walt indicated, I was the only surgeon here. And over in Lexington, It was in a similar fashion. Frank Spencer really started the cardiac surgery program at University of Kentucky, and one of his colleagues, Gordon Danielson, is actually a well-known congenital heart surgeon who spent a few years there, but ultimately went to the Mayo Clinic. I think Ed Todd was really the surgeon who was involved with doing much of the congenital heart surgery before Bob Sally was hired in 1986. So in any event, so I was here in 1989, and Bob came in 1986, and really it's from that point on that I have the most knowledge about what's happened at both places since. It did get to the point, at least in Louisville, where I needed some help. Tom Yeh joined me in the late 90s. Subsequently, he moved, and Mike Mitchell, who trained at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, joined me. And then Mike got recruited away to go to Milwaukee, where he is currently the chief of cardiac surgery in Milwaukee. Chris Mascio followed him, also trained at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And Chris worked with me for a good while until he got recruited back to CHOP, and now he's actually the chief of pediatric cardiac surgery in West Virginia. Deb Kosick joined me after Chris left, and Deb was over in Lexington. And Frank Pagula came and spent a couple of years, and then we were lucky to recruit the current chief of cardiac surgery at the Children's Hospital, Baha Al-Sufi. We were able to get him to come from Emory in Atlanta. Back in Lexington, Bob Sally, probably of all those there, really provided the congenital heart surgery most of that period of time. And Bob, after into the late 90s, he decided to join the private group in town. So he was doing, although he continued to basically help the folks over at UK, he stepped away from the regular care and surgery of particularly the youngest patients, but moved across the street and has continued to do heart surgery. And I know all of you here who are in Lexington know Bob very well. I've had the pleasure of knowing him all these years and quite aware of his talents as a heart surgeon for both adults and children. But after Bob joined the private group, the university wanted to have their own congenital surgeon, and Simon Abraham spent several years there, followed by Bill Douglas, who had trained in Michigan. And then when Bill left, Mark Plunkett came from UCLA, and he hired an assistant, Deb, fully trained, but to help him out, Deb Kosick. And when the program was put on hold, and Mark left, I was able to recruit Deb to come over to Louisville. As you probably know, after there was a pause for a couple of years in Lexington, and fortunately, the UK developed a strong relationship with the Children's Hospital in Cincinnati, and to their credit, they provided two excellent heart surgeons. First was Jim Quintessenza, and then when Jim got called back to All Children's Hospital in St. Petersburg, Cincinnati Children's provided us with Carl Backer. And I must say, both of those are senior surgeons, excellent. Carl, who is now the primary surgeon at UK, was a former president of the Congenital Heart Surgeon Society. And I must say, everybody here is are good friends of mine. So I'm happy to identify everybody here as having a significant part in playing of what's occurred with congenital heart surgery in Kentucky. Now, having sort of related to Kentucky per se, I want to bring up a few things. See, before I got here, this happened at Kosher Children's Hospital, and this was Gus Mavrudis. This was 1986, and in a lot of ways, it kind of put a little hospital in in Kentucky on the map. And frankly, at this particular time, I was back in North Carolina and had recognized this. So from my perspective, it certainly raised some interest, and it made it so that when Gus was recruited to go to Chicago, the opening came up and I got an invite to come look at the position. And needless, because of this and other things that had occurred, I was clearly interested in the position. And while a number of people looked at the job and were interviewed, I was fortunate enough to get the position. And as I said, I've been here ever since. So back in 1989, when I came, Bob was already here. I apologize for the photo of me because I didn't have a younger one that was immediately available. Bob, he always looks young, so I think he looked the same back then as he does now. But that's what happened in 1989, and that's where we were. I think we were the only two in the state who were performing congenital heart surgery at that time. And so this is kind of my view looking backwards. And I think it's fair to say, and that's my job to support by what I'm gonna say, that we've provided congenital heart surgery and have kept pace with what's been provided in the rest of the world. I do think it's helpful to go back to 1980s, and I suspect there are people here who might not have even been alive back in 1989. So in any event, if I'm looking back, I've got to go back to what we thought about congenital heart disease and congenital heart surgery back in the 1980s so that we can kind of see what's happened since that time. And clearly ASDs and PDAs, that's something that, you know, a congenital heart surgeon did like to do. They were relatively straightforward, good success. The other thing, transposition of the great arteries was something that was well known. And we had operations for it. The operation to switch the circulations was primarily done at the atrial level, and there were two procedures, which I'll describe a little bit in a minute, and then tell you how we progressed to an anatomic surgical procedure. Single ventricles, clearly single ventricles are common. We primarily know it as tricuspid atresia. Back in the 1980s, and certainly before 1980, if somebody was diagnosed with hypoplastic left heart syndrome, you talked to the family and you told them that the news was not good and they could spend some time with the child after he or she was born and they would all pass away. It was about this time that we were recognizing there were options. One option was transplantation, and that photo I showed with the Gus in that little heart, that was in a child with hypoplastic left heart syndrome. So transplantation was an option. We, of course, know that there's a limitation to donor hearts, so it wasn't the best option in a lot of ways. And then, of course, there became something called the Norwood procedure, which is something that's been important for all of us in the business over the last 30 years. Another thing that we all had to consider was how good are we doing compared to other centers? Mostly it was hard to tell back then. Really all you had to go by was what was published in the literature. And as you know, if you wrote a paper, well, you didn't really report your bad results. And if you were gonna write a paper, you had good results. And so you were saying, well, let's see, am I as good as them? And you look at ours and from the standpoint of making sure that you're providing the best care, how do you compare to other centers? So we really didn't know that well. The other thing is that I think you understand, we pretty much understood that if a heart stopped and you couldn't get it back with CPR, well, then it was all over. I think you all know that's not the case these days. Another thing that I think we knew, but it was one of our interests about what's happening to the brain during heart surgery. And then, of course, do we even have to worry about adults with a heart defect? Back then, most of them with serious heart defects weren't surviving to adulthood. Well, let's see. I thought it would be, I should choose some things that I thought were notable over the last 30 years, and these clearly isn't everything, but I'll briefly go through each one of these things. including interventional cardiology, which is obviously incredibly important for adult patients with acquired disease. I mentioned the arterial switch operation, which relates to transposition, how we deal with patients born with one ventricle, intraoperative neuromonitoring, which is something that we became very interested in, self-evaluation, mechanical support, and the adult with congenital heart disease. So, percutaneous interventions. Well, those ASDs and PDAs, which were easy cases, they got stolen, and rightfully so. I think all of us are, first off, you got to think about yourself, your own child. You want to get the most success with the least trauma, and it's hard to argue that being able to fix something with a catheter rather than a large incision and splitting open the sternum would be advantageous. And I'm sure many of you can recognize these images. This is clearly a pulmonary stenosis is something that does occur often in neonates, can be significant. It used to require surgery, now it doesn't. It can be taken care of in the cath lab with the balloon. Same with the aortic valve. The aortic valve stenosis in a newborn can be life-threatening. It used to require surgery, and now can be addressed in the cath lab. Coarctation of the aorta, same thing. This is hasn't worked out as well for neonates except at some centers, but it's definitely of value in older patients with coarctation, such as in this particular example. And in order to make sure whatever you do with the balloon stays that way, the idea of putting a stent where you dilated up a narrowing in the aorta was appropriate. Surgeons having to deal with pulmonary arteries, it's nice that we can actually get some help from our interventional colleagues, because going back to enlarge these narrowings after a previous surgery is difficult, and so we really appreciate having their approach and availability. Of course, if the patent ductus arteriosus is something that we typically would close, and it was the easy case, close in the cath lab in this instance. And I always strike this as interesting. So, okay, we just closed the PDA in one patient. Now, why would you stent a PDA? Well, it relates to the business we're in. I mean, there's such a diversity of conditions in congenital heart disease. In this particular case, this is a child born with pulmonary atresia, and the only way that blood was going to get to the child's lungs was through the ductus arteriosus, or the surgeon can go to the operating room and put in a shunt. And that's really what we used to do. But it turns out now the child can go to the cath lab and we can keep the duct open. Now, that's not a long-term solution, but if you're dealing with a very small infant and you want to get the child to the point where you can actually do surgery, where you can reconstruct the pulmonary arteries and hook them up to the right ventricle, these patients all have a VSD and close that. All of that can be done. It's much better if you can stabilize them until they're 5 kilograms rather than if they're 1.5 kilograms. So this is a striking advantage to be able to have a colleague who can help you in the cath lab. And of course, closing ASDs. And we all love this. We don't get many of these anymore in surgery. And honestly, and clearly, you all know when you encounter an adult with an ASD that somehow got missed along the way, most of these can be closed in the cath lab with the device, and the outcomes are quite good, and they don't require a surgeon. Some of the patients need to have a pulmonary valve replaced. Particularly if they'd had surgery for a tetralogy of Fallot when they were younger. We used to think they could go forever. We've discovered that actually their right ventricle starts to fail. They need to have a valve put in. We do put them in surgically, but in many cases, an interventionalist can insert a valve, and this is one of them. So, fewer easy cases for us. I mean, that's okay. We have to accept that in our business. But many of the difficult cases are actually taken care of easier on everybody, most importantly the patient. And some hybrid approaches have been developed where both the surgeon and the interventionalist work together. And we've found that having this relationship between the interventional cardiologist and the surgeon has been a tremendous benefit to the whole practice and again, most importantly, to our patients. So I mentioned transposition of the great arteries. I think we understand that if you're born with this and nothing's done, the chances are you're not going to live to be a year old. And if your ventricular septum is intact, you're probably not going to make it to a month. Fortunately, a number of things have been learned. The interventional cardiologist actually developed a way to at least support these children for a little while until something can be done. And that's basically doing a balloon septostomy. There's another interventionalist coming in working with us. That gets them to where bigger, where they can have a procedure to switch the circulations. This was one of the techniques that was developed by Dr. Senning way back in 1957 is when he described it. And so it became a procedure that a number of surgeons would utilize. Again, this was not something you could do in a newborn, but in a child that was maybe 6 months to a year, you could do it. Another technique, which many surgeons preferred, was actually using a piece of the patient's own pericardium to develop baffles inside the atrium to redirect the blood flow. Both of these worked reasonably well. But again, the issue was really the child who has a intact ventricular septum and is unstable. And one of the reasons that you can't switch the great arteries in early, I mean, later on, after they've been out for 6 months or so, is that the left ventricle has been working against a low pressure, and so it loses strength. And if you do an arterial switch late, there's a big risk that the heart won't survive it. So someone had developed an operation that to do this switch, Dr. Jatin, and this particular case, when the first ones that he did were done with in children who had a ventricular septal defect. If you have a large ventricular septal defect, that means the pressure in the left ventricle and right ventricle are about the same, so you've actually made it so that if you do an arterial switch, the left ventricle is still strong enough to take over. So honestly, the arterial switch was something that was appropriately applied in children with a ventricular septal defect. It wasn't thought necessarily that you could do it in patients who did not have a ventricular septal defect until it was recognized that if you didn't wait too long, that the left ventricle was still strong. And when I say not too long, if you do it while they're a newborn in the first week or two of life, you can actually do an arterial switch and have success with it. And there you go. This surgeon, well-known surgeon, Aldo Castaneda at Boston Children's, actually did an arterial switch in a baby who was 11 days old. And this really started the whole idea of doing transposition surgery and an anatomic repair with an arterial switch. And he taught a number of other people around the country. Turns out that actually I was a fellow at Boston Children's in 1987, where I learned how to do the arterial switch and brought it back to North Carolina, where I was at the time. But interestingly, we'd already been doing it in Kentucky. And in 1985, Dr. Mavroudis, who I had already mentioned, and who preceded me at U of L, he actually, in January 1985, so only 2 years after the procedure that was first done by Dr. Castaneda at Boston Children's, he was doing it then, and he had 88% survival. And so arterial switch in a newborn with transposition was being done here. And I can tell you, in most of the country, very few centers were actually doing the arterial switch other than up in Boston Children's. Turns out here in Kentucky. And I didn't know at the time, but I found out from talking with Bob Sally that it wasn't too long after Gus was doing his arterial switches in Louisville that Bob was doing them in Lexington. And so Kentucky was ahead of most of the game in doing arterial switches for transposition of the great artery. So I think we should be proud of that. It was subsequently discovered that if you compared the techniques, that the survival using both approaches was equal. And this is now decades after it was all started, we've actually realized that if you'd had an arterial switch as a newborn, as opposed to going a atrial switch, and you can see the I can make this work. Let's see, is it working? There we go. You can see the difference. This arterial switch, survival, atrial switch, survival. So we know that that was a good switch over to an operation that nowadays virtually anybody who is in the business of congenital heart surgery can do with this kind of success. I mentioned single ventricles. We know that there are a fair number of those, and clearly it ranges from tricuspid atresia to hypoplastic left heart syndrome, and there are a lot in between. Those of you in the audience who are in this business know that there are a lot of these in between. I suspect if you're in the adult business primarily, you're not so aware, but this is important, and it's become important because of this operation, which started for tricuspid atresia, and now has been pretty much applied to any other situation that's born with a single ventricle. It just shows that it has evolved over time, and but this was a big deal. Dr. Norwood, he was up at Boston Children's at the time, developed this operation for hypoplastic left heart syndrome. As I mentioned before, he'd come up with this. Patients with this diagnosis were just allowed to pass away in their parents' arms. But having said that, even though he came up with this, it took a while for this to catch on because it's still a difficult operation with the high mortality. Certainly in the 80s, the mortality in most people's hands was over 50%, if not higher. This just shows his publication after he'd actually gotten the patient all the way successfully through a Fontan operation. And then other, additions to the surgical management of single ventricles have come a long way, and most of these surgeons have all contributed, and we clearly at this particular time, and certainly by the late 90s, were taking advantage of all of these approaches. I think we do know that if you can have two ventricles and make two ventricles work, that's the best way to go. And this actually shows the fact that that over time, patients who've had a Fontan operation, that their survival is clearly less than what a patient with two ventricles would be, and the increasing mortality. And in both places, we have a lot of patients who we've done the Fontan operation on. We're pleased that we've added years to their lives, but now we're dealing with issues as they get older. And this is becoming a big part of what pediatric cardiologists who are now taking care of adults with congenital heart disease are having to deal with. Intraoperative neuromonitoring, I bring this up because this has been of some interest to our program. Needless to say, as we get better and better with getting patients to survive complicated heart operations, it's not great if the heart and the rest of the body is okay and the child has had a neurologic insult during the process. And of course, the neurologic abnormality may not be related to the operation. Could it be what they're born with, situation that they're born with? It could be something that happens later. But if you're a surgeon and you recognize the fact that you have the delivery of oxygen to a child's brain while you're performing this procedure, much of the time with the heart stopped. It's a high responsibility, and it's one that we've taken seriously. Our group back in 95 actually started this interoperative neural monitoring. And although it's still it's commonly done most places nowadays with transcranial near-infrared spectroscopy, we actually felt that having additional modalities was important. And there was an anesthesiologist that encouraged us to proceed with this. His name was Harvey Edmonds. And I agreed to our proceeding with actually monitoring these things in the patients that I operated on. And this just shows the EEG, transcranial Doppler, and near-infrared spectroscopy. And this is what it looks like. Basically, it has the EEG leads. You see the transcranial Doppler probe, the infrared spectroscopy patches. All three of these things are things that we were using routinely. And it does require somebody actually monitoring those things. And this is, and it shows you what all three of those areas are monitored by someone during the case. And if an issue comes up that suggests there's a problem with the delivery of blood or oxygen to the brain, the perfusionist, the anesthesiologist, the surgeon are all notified, so we can make sure that there's not an issue that's affecting that and something that we can address. We actually did a study at our own institution, and we basically found that of those where we identified an abnormality and we did not intervene, compared to those that we did intervene, we significantly decreased the incidence of neurologic complications. And we also recognized that abnormalities in perfusion oxygenation actually occur relatively commonly. And we felt that using this technique, we could intervene and significantly decrease that. And as a result, this is something that we continue to do. Even though we did this back in the 90s, we do it today, tomorrow. It's something that we completely rely on. Self-evaluation, of course, everybody needs to do this. but it's not easy to do when you're not sure what to compare to. You need to look at your outcomes and how things go. An important part of that is using databases. Databases were not common when I was started here, but they've become significantly common over the last 30 years. This is one thing that struck me, and this is back in the early 90s. Mark DeLaval, very well-known congenital surgeon at Great Ormond Street in London, also a co-author of a textbook in congenital heart surgery that most all of us relied on. He became pretty good at doing the arterial switch, and then he happened to notice that he was having some mortalities. And you're particularly struck by this, his actually picking up on this factor, and he actually presented the fact that, listen, things aren't going well for me, and he put together this presentation. He presented it to the American Association of Thoracic Surgeons, and one of the things he clearly did is he stopped doing the arterial switch once he realized how things were going, and he told himself he tried to look and figure what it was, and he just decided he knew another surgeon in Great Britain that was very good at it, and so he stopped doing it himself. And he actually retrained with that surgeon and then was able to recommence with good outcomes and no mortality. But this is sort of, I found this very striking. And also, it's also notable that in Great Britain, there was this episode with a hospital that did congenital heart surgery, Bristol. And Bristol had issues and a high mortality rate, and it sort of got, the word got out that that was an issue. And they actually ended up stopped doing congenital heart surgery at Bristol for a number of years till they looked into it. And clearly they had to look at the oversight of the surgeons and looking at their outcomes and monitoring them regularly so that if anything turned up, they could adjust for it. And in any event, I think it's important that we keep an eye on those sorts of things. This is databases, as I referred to. The most significant one that we are part of now is the Society of Thoracic Surgeons Congenital Database, which we give data to. And over the past two decades now, virtually all centers that do congenital heart surgery in the United States submit data regularly to the outcomes of the procedures that they perform. It does give us benchmarks, so you know if you got a group of centers that do that surgery, you know what their outcomes are. You can tell whether or not you're doing as well as them, and it's important to know that. There was some concern about it, and there's still some concern, but I do think that the databases are here to stay. We've actually developed a dashboard so that we could look at our own outcomes. But this is just one of the things that from a regular report, usually once or twice a year from the STS Congenital Database, you actually get to see how you're doing compared to other centers. This is stat mortalities relate to how risky a set of procedures is. One of the big problems with congenital heart disease is a big spectrum of lesions and operations. ASD, shouldn't lose an ASD. A Norwood operation, that's different. High risk operation. But they're also, we do about 50 different types of operations in this business. And so they've been sort of set based on what their expected outcomes are from what we've learned from prior datas, that we've sort of created these different categories, and this is a stat mortality category 4, which is pretty close to the highest, and this was from one of our reports. I don't know if you can see it here. This is us. So the good news is we were right along with the mean of everybody else, but you also get a feeling for what everybody else is doing. And clearly, if you're down here, that means you have a relatively fair number of cases. If you're here, you probably don't have any. So if your mortality is zero, good for you. But it might be you only have 5 cases and they all made it. So, but nevertheless, this is something that allows you to kind of assess your own data. One of the things that has been of some concern is that the fact that the data has gotten to where it gets reported publicly. This is the dashboard I was referring to, and I don't want you to go through it in any detail, but the idea is to be able to, from us, and it basically sort of shows we looked at the stat categories, we looked at our outcomes as far as mortality and whether they went on ECMO and so forth, but it's important to be able to kind of follow this closely, so if there's any issues, you can pick them up early. So again, having a dashboard like that, encourage you to look at your outcomes on a regular basis so you're not discovering late that something should have been addressed. And then the public reporting side of it is something that we understand that there's obviously a big push, particularly from families. They like to know what all the centers are doing. It is a little difficult because each center has a different mix. You might have all your cases are ASDs and VSDs, or you might have a whole bunch of Norwoods or other high-risk things, and they all sort of get mixed together. So that case mix can make it very difficult for a non-medical person to look at the data and think, well, that program has high mortality, and this one has low mortality. I'm going to go to the low mortality one. Well, you go to the low mortality center that has very little experience with the high mortality procedures. So there is an issue. And the other factor, which I think is an important one, that Tom Spray and Bill Gaynor up at Children's Hospital brought this up, and I think it's true. If if too much is reported publicly, then you're going to say, well, listen, this is a pretty tough case, and it might not make it, so I don't think we should do it. I think that's unfortunate part of the public reporting side of things. You don't want to have a system where you're afraid to take on a patient with increased risk. mechanical support. I think it's we all know nowadays that there's a situation where we want to, if we have a chance of keeping a patient alive, when we now have ways to do that. I think ECMO, when I started, was only used in the NICU for newborns with respiratory distress. It wasn't too long before we realized you can use it to support the heart and the lungs. And so there's a disadvantage because you can't use it for so long. Usually after about a week of ECMO, you start having complications. What do you do for a longer time if you got a patient that just can't be supported only with ECMO and as a potential for transplant? Well, the Berlin heart got developed in the 90s, and this is basically shows you two of them, a little one and a big one, and obviously it relates to the size of the patient that needs the support. This shows that there are several different sizes. One of the key things with the Berlin heart is that it's extracorporeal. That means in order to take over for the heart, it's got to be outside, and you've got to put big tubes in the heart, and they kind of come out through the abdominal wall. And this definitely works, and this has really been important support for these patients. This actually shows a patient who has a Berlin heart, both, and it is potential that they can actually get up and sit in the parent's lap. And just from the history of it, it was first, obviously because it's called the Berlin heart, you can imagine it was developed in Germany. And it didn't really get implanted in the United States until 2000. And it was studied to see if we could actually use it and get FDA approval. We finally got the FDA device exemption in December 2011. I was involved, I was actually on the FDA committee that was involved in this. And the decision was really based on comparing how well patients did with the Berlin heart compared to ECMO. And it's pretty obvious that they did better. And since these things were primarily used to support a patient for transplantation, and we know you can't just take a heart off the shelf if you need a donor heart, this actually was an important step forward. Again, it is used, the Berlin heart is extracorporeal. It is important to also know, and those of you who are in mechanical support in adults know that a lot has occurred over the last 30 years for mechanical support in the adults. There are several devices that are used in adults, and can you use them in a child? And they have been. One of them is the HeartWare, which we use in several children. And actually, it worked for us and actually got them to successful transplants. The unfortunate thing is that there were issues with it, and within the last, about a year ago, it was withdrawn from the market because of issues with the device would cut off and he couldn't get it started again. You can imagine that's a difficult situation. We never had that experience, but it happened enough that the company was obliged to withdraw it from the market. The newest adult device, the HeartMate 3, actually works pretty well. We have had experience with that. It is important to notice that both of these devices are inside the body. They don't have big tubes coming out, and that's a real advantage. And we have actually had experience with a couple of patients recently using the HeartMate 3, and it's worked well for us, but they were teenagers and they were bigger patients. The problem still exists for the younger child, and so what in a small child that's less than 20 kilograms, and that's a lot of what we deal with, we don't have an intracorporeal approach. The NHLBI actually recognized this all the way back in 2002 and asked for some proposals to see if you could get a device, and actually a number of people gave proposals. Actually, a fair list came out. It got narrowed down to five, but within a few years, everything dropped out except this. wrong button, there we go. This is the Jarvik 2000. This is Dr. Jarvik is the same Dr. Jarvik of the complete artificial heart, but this is a left ventricular assist device. And the thing about this is that it is designed so that it works similar to those adult devices. What you're seeing right there goes into the apex. You can see this is this right here goes into the apex of the ventricle, and then this goes to the aorta. And again, that makes this intracorporeal. It was the only intracorporeal device for a younger or smaller child that was available. And so this was called the, I'll go back again, just the PUMPKIN trial, Pumps for Kids, Infants, and Neonates. And so that has been going on since 2002. I've actually continued to serve on the data safety monitoring board for that, so I've been following this thing, and it's been slow going. The 2000 VAD that was we thought we would go with, turns out there was a lot of hemolysis, and they had to change to a slightly bigger device called the 2015, which they completed in 2015, and then slowly wanted to start a trial to actually try it out. The idea initially was to have two arms, but ultimately they decided to start with a feasibility trial, single-armed, and patients who are 8 to 20 kilograms. Enrollment was very slow. But right now, the feasibility trial is essentially completed with only 7 children, 4 U.S. centers. The good news is that all 7 children survived to transplant. And so they put together a pivotal trial, which hopefully will get started soon, where we get more information. They supposedly have 22 planned, but we'll have to see how that goes. In the meantime, we're stuck with this still, which works. But needless to say, if you have a child, a small child with all of these things coming out and having to support them, you're thinking, boy, I'd love to have something that was inside like we have for the adult population. And then finally, the adult congenital disease. I've noticed in reading about David that's become a big part of his practice now. And I think adult congenital heart disease is important, and it relates to the fact that we've gotten young children beginning in infancy to a stage where they can be adults, but it doesn't mean that they're perfect. And we have to deal with all of these things. Some of them are unrepaired. Some of them are complications of previous ones. And all of these things are factors that cardiologists need to deal with and need to obviously have a fair understanding of congenital heart disease. We actually looked back in 2011, my younger associate, Chris Masio, and I used the STS database to see how things were. Now, that was 10 years ago. Things have changed. But back then, there were a lot of patients who had congenital heart disease surgery of some sort. It could be ASD or it could be something more complex. In any event, they did pretty well. I think that there are more patients now who have Fontans and other sorts of things that we'll be dealing with. So it's past time to do this study again. So the population is clearly increasing in number. The Adult Congenital Heart Association was established recognizing the increasing number of these folks and actually began an accreditation program in 2017. I'm pleased to be able to say that our hospital, Norton Children's Hospital, is accredited. And Cincinnati Children's, which works, of course, very closely with University of Kentucky, is also accredited. And clearly both centers have groups of cardiologists who are dedicated to these patients. So looking back over those things and how we've done in the last 30 years, I think it's resulted in an improvement in death rate. You look at some specific procedures more commonly provided, I think we've done better, at least as far as mortality goes. Here's looking using the SCS Congenital Heart Surgery Database out through 2014. I think we've made an improvement. Again, this relates again to the stat categories, and this, of course, is going to be the highest stats, which means the highest risk. Very high then. We've come down, and I'm aware, although I don't have it on the slide, that it continues to come down for all of these. So much has been learned. I think much has been accomplished. The easier lesions are now managed with good success in many cases in the cath lab. And there's been a significant improvement in the complicated ones due to a lot of things, including teamwork. And in Kentucky, I think we've been keeping pace. I definitely want to refer to what's going on in UK and Kentucky Children's Hospital. They have this joint heart care program with Cincinnati Children's Hospital, which has been very important. Carl Backer, who's a good friend, is the chief of pediatric cardiothoracic surgery there. And actually, he's newly become the editor of the World Journal of Pediatric and Congenital Heart Surgery. And clearly, and I think some of you are here, we got cardiology and pediatric specialists from Lexington and Cincinnati who contribute to how well congenital heart disease is addressed in Lexington and UK. Here in Louisville, we have as we've grown, we've actually turned ourselves into a heart institute. We felt that being a heart institute, we have the opportunity to sort of break down barriers between silos so that we work together better. The two directors are the head of our cardiac surgery and cardiology program, Baha Al-Sufi and Brian, who you've already heard from. The two primary surgeons are Baha and Deb Kosick. I'm still a PRN surgeon, but I'm supposed to be retired. So you got two plus maybe 0.1. In any event, there are two surgeons here all the time. And we're now up to 31 providers. I think back to 1989 when I came here, there were really four cardiologists. And so I think we're pleased with the progress we've made, and obviously in these different areas, and including the places we see as well. I do want to say that this was recent, basically really in this month's Congenital Cardiology Today, which many of us in this field get, shows that we actually recently implanted really kind of the smallest pacemaker in a very small infant. This was a premature neonate who required a pacemaker, and we were able to actually implant this tiny pacemaker. And we were the first to actually utilize this, and you can sort of see this x-ray of it right here. And I did want to just say that we have contributed, I think, to the literature, and I don't want you to go through each one of these things. The point is to see that there's a fair number, a couple of things you might note, and there's several different areas. And I also have this as number one because there's more. And I must say, in addition to having identified Dr. Al-Sufi as a superb congenital heart surgeon, this guy is incredibly prolific, and you'll see his name attached. These are everything I'm going to show you are papers that have been published or are due to be published in the past 2 years. So these several papers that relate to heart transplantation, mechanical support. Again, you'll see Baha in there. There are a few, you might see my name here and there, but for the most part, we've continued to provide new information to our field. Bottom line, I think we've done pretty well, and the future's bright. Thank you. He's asking for questions. Anybody have a question? It's not working, but
this one's better. Any questions for
Dr. I see some pediatric cardiologists out there. Come on, guys.
I've got a question. Dr. Ross, thanks you for that. You did a great job of blowing lots of other people's horns for them. And one thing you didn't touch on, and I know you were an early advocate of the Ross procedure for aortic stenosis in young people and young adults. And I know there's been a lot of progress in the outcomes of that that you might want to discuss briefly. And there's a lot of adult cardiologists in the audience who might want to know, because that aortic stenosis is a common
disease.
Those of us
who are, there's a lot of, I don't know what we've seen on it. You're talking into two different mics or something. It sounds like there's a lot of echo. In any event, those of us who are in congenital heart surgery have to deal with the aortic valve a lot. It's been clear to us that in the child that needs an aortic valve replacement, that the Ross operation is the best. For those of you who, just to be clear, the Ross operation is taking the patient's own pulmonary valve and moving it into the aortic position. And then, of course, you've got to replace the pulmonary valve, and typically it's done with a homograft, a pulmonary homograft. It's a more difficult operation than slamming in a mechanical valve. And there's a lot of advantages to putting in a mechanical valve in some situations. But for the most part, the Ross operation has potential for growth. And it turns out the data shows that this operation is quite good, not just for the child who doesn't have many options, but for the young adult. And although there's a strong leaning towards if you happen to be 25 years old, you need to have an aortic valve replacement, there's a strong leaning towards having the valve replaced with the mechanical valve because it'll persist, but then you're still stuck with the anticoagulation issue. You can go with a tissue valve, and now that there's TAVR, you put the thing in, and when it wears out, well, then our good old interventionalist can come in and put in another one inside the one you already put in. So that is an option. But it is interesting, and as more and more data comes out, looking at comparison between the Ross operation, and I'm talking about all, and specifically the young adult, the Ross operation, the mechanical valve replacement, the tissue valve replacement, you compare all of them, they all do pretty well, but the survival, the only group that has a survival that is essentially the same as somebody with a normal aortic valve is the Ross operation. So I think it's important that if you take care of these patients and they need to have their aortic valve replaced, you should definitely consider the Ross operation. Now, most adult surgeons don't do the Ross operation. But some do. I know Bob Sally does. Bob and I have been doing them together at different places the whole time we've been here. And obviously Bob, so if you've got a young adult in Lexington, they need to have an aortic valve replacement, call Bob, although Bob told me he's retiring next spring. So you need to do it soon. Or you can send it to us. I can tell you that my partner, Dr. Al-Sufi, does a terrific Ross operation. So in any event, it is a procedure that I think is important and typically is done by those of us who primarily do congenital heart surgery.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you again, Dr. Austin,
not only
for your talk, but for your 33 years.